So thank you all. We're really excited to be here. A lot of times, Michael and I are both psychiatrists, and we spend a lot of time talking to psychiatrists, mainly because a lot of psychiatrists don't always think about the social determinants of mental health. So we're actually really excited to be presenting today to public health folks who kind of intrinsically get these concepts a little bit better than the audiences we're typically speaking to. So we're going to start off with some definitions, and I'm going to provide a little bit of a historical context and present a few key concepts that we all need to know. And then Michael is going to provide a review of the evidence for three of the specific social determinants of mental health that we've identified that has a lot of good evidence to support it, but also just so you can start to get a brief snapshot, because we don't have time to go through the evidence for all of the determinants that we've identified. And then finally, we're going to take some time to think about solutions. And actually, I'm hoping that's where we can all kind of put our heads together. I consider you all to be the experts on these types of issues, and I think that you have the key to how we can move forward and really start to go in the right direction on this. So hopefully that will be more of a dialogue. So the social determinants of health, and I believe some of this will be a review for some of you, but we all know that the World Health Organization defines this as those factors that impact upon health and well-being, the circumstances into which we are born, grow up, live, work, and age, and also adding that it includes the health system, although that's a smaller piece of the puzzle. And then the World Health Organization goes on to one additional point, which I think is crucial in this definition, which is that these circumstances are shaped by the distribution of money, power, and resources at the global, national, and local levels, which are themselves influenced by policy choices. The reason that part of the definition is so key is because it gets at the fundamental issue here, which is we have a choice. We actually have a choice in the matter, and these are decisions that are consciously made that have an influence on the health of people in our society. And then the last part of the definition that's also really key here is that social determinants of health are prominently responsible for health disparities and health inequities. So not only are they the situations which we grow up in and live in, but they're also the conscious decisions that we make based on the policies that we choose to support. And they lead to the disparities and inequities that we see in both health and in mental health. So just to remind you, we define health disparities as differences in health status among distinct segments of the population. It could be gender, it could be race or ethnicity, education, income, disability, or where you live. And then typically this definition does not make a value judgment. It just says there are differences. The word inequities then takes it to the value place, where disparities in health are a result of systemic, avoidable, and unjust social and economic policies and practices that create barriers to opportunity. So in this country, we tend to use these terms interchangeably. In other countries, inequities has the value on it that these are unfair differences and disparities are just differences. So it's a different way to think about it, but I've come to the point where I tend to refer to these things as inequities now instead of disparities when I'm talking about differences that we have in mental health status. So the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation many years ago discovered that depending on your political persuasion, the social determinants of health is not always seen in a positive light. It has a lot to do with the language you use, the words that we use, and for whatever reason, the social determinants of health, it doesn't resonate with every political group and every political process. So they did an extensive study and found that there were specific terms that tend to resonate more, because the truth of the matter is everybody cares about these issues, no matter what their political persuasion. However, it just doesn't resonate. The language doesn't resonate the same. So they found that certain terms and certain phrases resonate with everybody, no matter if you're Republican, Democrat, or independent. And one of those phrases was, health begins where we live, learn, work, and play. So that's just kind of a general statement that really defines the social determinants of health, but does a little bit of a non-value-laden statement that everybody hears and resonates and says, That makes sense to me. And the other one, which I think is just a really key way to think about things, is that your zip code may be more important to your overall health than your genetic code. And we know that. We talk about healthography. We talk about these types of location-based health differences that we see in health inequities. So your zip code may be more important to your overall health than your genetic code. And this map kind of is an example of that. And if you look, if you're from Montgomery County, Maryland, your life expectancy is about 81 years. And if you're from Marlborough, I always have problems saying that, Marlborough County, South Carolina, your life expectancy is about 69 years. So, you know, you have a significant over 10-year difference in life expectancy depending on where you live. And so what we're really talking about are issues of social justice. So let's go ahead and just define what social justice is. And David Miller, the philosopher, defined it as the distribution of good, which he termed advantages, and bad, or disadvantages, in society. And more specifically, how these things should be distributed in society. So it's concerned with the ways that resources are allocated to people by social institutions. So it's how we put how we decide who gets what, how we decide who gets advantages in our society and who gets disadvantages in our society. And then John Rawls took this definition one step further, which is key when we're thinking about social justice, which is assuring the protection of equal access to liberties, rights, and opportunities, as well as taking care of the least advantaged members of society. I think that's really key when we're talking about mental health, because oftentimes people with serious mental illness do end up as the least advantaged members of society. And so when we're talking about social justice, when we're thinking about mental health issues, there's really a synergy there that we really need to focus on, because these are folks in our society that oftentimes are pushed down to the bottom rungs of our society. So how exactly does social justice relate to health? Well, we consider social justice to be the moral foundation of public health. It's why public health does what it does. It's about making sure that everybody has the same opportunities for health. And it also ensures that individuals have equal opportunities to have healthy lives. So now that's a brief overview of health and the social determinants of health. But let's start to think about how mental health is related to this topic. And back in the late 1800s, this man, Emile Durkheim, started noticing that there was a connection between suicide and social exclusion. And so he was one of the first people to think about suicide as a social phenomenon. The more isolated, the more excluded people were, the higher the rates of suicide in that group. So we've been thinking about social factors and how they influence mental health for quite some time. Then in 1939, this is Chicago, where we are right now, and Ferris and Dunham found that there was a very clear association between social disorganization and schizophrenia rates. So on this map, you can see the darkest areas of the most central aspects of Chicago had the highest level of social disorder, and they also had the highest rates of schizophrenia. And they were also the poorest areas in Chicago. And as you go out from the central, that central part of Chicago to the more outlying sections, you see lower and lower rates of schizophrenia. And you know, we all know that there's a number of reasons for that, but part of it is thinking about how, just considering how our environment and our society and these environmental factors play a role in our overall mental health. So in the field of psychiatry, there was this time in the 1990s called the Decade of the Brain. And what we found was this great rise of biological psychiatry. And this is, you know, for the non-psychiatrists in the room, this was a time where, from a mental health perspective, we made great strides. We were looking at molecular and genetic risk factors and determinants of health. We did a lot in terms of advances in research in genetics and neurobiology and pharmacology. And a lot of people feel some great things were done at that time. And that's true. But one of the, I think, unfortunate byproducts of the Decade of the Brain is that we really started to not look as much at social processes. and how those social processes contribute to mental illness. Instead, we started focusing on genes and biology, and we moved away from the environment and how those factors impact. And it really comes down to this issue of nature versus nurture. And we all know, this debate has been resolved for a long time now, that it isn't really nature versus nurture, it's nature and nurture. And we know that you can't really understand biology without understanding the social environmental context. And you can't really understand how these social factors have a role without understanding neurobiology. And that's the whole rise of the field of epigenetics, gene by environment interactions, and the fact that we know that there's an interplay here that's very important. And then it's a little hard to see that, but this graph, this chart shows the determinants of health and the role that they play in contributing to premature death. So I can tell you, if you can't see that the dark blue is behavioral patterns, which is 40%. And then the light blue is healthcare, 10%. That purple is environmental exposure, 5%. And then social circumstances are green, and that's 15%. So genetic predisposition makes up 30% of this pie chart, which means that 70% of these determinants of health that contribute to premature death are all environmental and social factors. And then we just talked about nature versus nurture, so we also understand that even those genetic determinants aren't solely genetic, that they do have also some social and environmental influence as well. So when we think about how much contributes to illness and death in this country, and all over, we have to think about all of these social determinants and how they play a massive role. And the other thing that's really helpful is that social determinants are actually modifiable. We can change those. Much easier than we can change genetics, we can actually change the environment that people live in. So I'm going to do a quick review for all of you public health specialists on prevention and risk factors, because they're so key when we're talking about social determinants of mental health. And this is very, very basic stuff, and everybody knows this stuff, but I'm just going to, I'm not even going to talk at all about universal and these types of preventive interventions. We're just going to talk about primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention really briefly. So we all know that primary prevention seeks to decrease the number of new cases or incidents of a disorder or illness, and it comes before the disease even happens. And the idea is that you're going to avoid the suffering, cost, and burden of the disease by intervening before the disease even starts. And we also all know that secondary prevention is seeking to lower the rate of established cases or reducing prevalence. And the idea is to identify and treat as early as possible with the disease to avoid the advanced disease and the symptoms that go along with it. And then tertiary prevention is really treatment. It's decreasing the disability associated with the disorder that already exists, and the goal is to reduce morbidity and mortality. And you're just trying to decrease the negative impact of the illness. So if we look at that all together, we're thinking about moving from a well population all the way to an established or diseased population, and that we have moments in which we can intervene at each of these steps. So you can intervene prior to primary prevention, at the primary prevention level, you can intervene at the at-risk population at a secondary prevention level, or you could intervene when the disease is already present for tertiary prevention. So keep that in the back of your mind, the places where you might intervene, because then that leads us to talk about risk factors and protective factors. And risk factors, as we know, also review, is a characteristic that precedes a disorder that's statistically associated with that disorder. And protective factors, as we know, are characteristics that predate disorders and significantly reduce the outcome of developing that disease. We don't spend enough time talking about protective factors and resilience. We're not going to spend enough time talking about that today in this talk, but I do want you all to know how important that is, and how it's something we need to come back to again and again. But when we're talking about the social determinants of mental health, and this is probably the fundamental thing that you all need to know today, is that it's referred to by Lincoln Phelan as the fundamental causes of disease. So if we think about it as risk factors being those things that precede disease, then the environmental and the contextual factors that precede or shape these risk factors are something that Rose and Sir Michael Marmot call the causes of the causes. So what comes even before the risk factor is the causes of the causes, and that's what we mean when we talk about the social determinants of mental health, what comes even before the risk factor that leads to the disease. So just to think about that, here's an example from Health Canada, which kind of really gets at the point that we're trying to make here about these fundamental causes of disease and the causes of causes. So to understand this, you have to think like a three-year-old, and you just keep asking why. So why is Jason in the hospital? Because he had a bad infection in his leg. But why does he have an infection? He has a cut on his leg, and it got infected. But why does he have a cut on his leg? He was playing in a junkyard next to his apartment building and fell on some sharp, jagged steel there. But why was he playing in a junkyard? His neighborhood is run down. Kids play there and there's no one there to supervise them. But why does he live in that neighborhood? His parents can afford a nicer place to live. But why can't his parents afford a nicer place to live? His dad is unemployed and his mom is sick. But why is his dad unemployed? Because he doesn't have much education and he can't find a job. And you could ask why and why and why and go on. And as you can see, what landed Jason in the hospital, if we go all the way back to the causes of the causes, the fundamental causes of disease, it had a lot to do with his dad's education and unemployment and these things we call the social determinants of mental health. So let's talk a little bit more about that. And this is our shameless plug for our book. Available online on Amazon, and also you can buy it on the American Psychiatric Association website. The reason that I bring it up here is because we've tried to conceptualize the social determinants of mental health in this book, and we know that we have not been 100% successful in doing that. These are really complex topics, and teasing them apart is almost impossible. Because they're so interconnected and so multidisciplinary that you cannot pull these individual social determinants apart, and you inevitably leave things out. And so I say that as a disclaimer, because we came up with nine social determinants of mental health, and that's not all of them, but those are the nine that we chose to focus on in this book. So I'll go over those really briefly. The first one is discrimination and social exclusion. And each one of these has a quote that's associated with them that we're not going to go into in great detail. Another one is adverse early childhood experiences, and this is one that we're going to spend a little bit more time delving into a little more deeply. Another one is education and poor education. Also unemployment. And that includes underemployment, where you're not, you don't have the job that you are at the level of which you can work, but you're just working. So a lot of people work part-time when they could be working full-time. That's underemployment. And then also the concept of job insecurity, which is when you have a job, but you live in constant fear that you're going to lose your job. Another one is poverty and income inequality, and we are going to spend some time focused on that one as well. Michael's going to go into that one in detail. And the other one we're going to spend time talking about today is food insecurity. And that one's a huge topic that's starting to now get a little bit more focused, but has been neglected for quite some time. And also housing, and that can be poor housing. That can be housing instability, it can be homelessness, and it has a little to do with the quality of housing as well, and if you live in poor quality housing. Also related to this, a huge topic that could be its own day-long presentation has to do with the built environment. We know that the built environment is everything that's man-made in society, so that encompasses a lot of things. It can include housing, but it can also include roadways, transportation, it can include parks, land use, all sorts of things, telecommunications. It's really hard to keep track of all of those, but that's one we are not going to go into in great detail today. And finally, health care, poor access to health care. We're also not going to focus on that one, but as we all know, that's a huge key. And as you saw, it's its own special kind of determinant in terms of how people access health and health care in this country. So we then took all of this and synthesized it into this conceptualization. And the G by E up in the far right corner stands for gene by environment interactions. But I want you to look at the top box, which says poor mental health, disease, and morbidity. And just like we think about when we think about the causes of causes, we're working backwards, right? So if the outcome is poor mental health, disease, and morbidity, if you go back, you're thinking about risk factors, right? And we talked about that. Risk factors precede the disease, so they come right before that. But if you go back even to before that, you get to things like reduced options, poor choices, high-risk behaviors, and stress. And you can note that the stress then impacts your genetics and creates toxins and pathogens that also lead to disease. But also that these things, options and choices, we sometimes tend to look at people and say, well, why are they choosing to make these really bad health choices? But many times they end up being the best of very limited options and few choices that people have. And they end up being reasonable options given the choices that are available to those folks. And then we say that the determinants that we just talked about drive these risk behaviors and options. And under all of that is this social justice issue, distribution of opportunity, and then the public policies and the social norms that interact to create that distribution of opportunity. So we're going to come back to this figure because it's going to help us think about how we might intervene and where we might intervene in order to have the greatest impact on the social determinants of mental health. And so I'd like to just point out that this is not new. We've been thinking about these topics for a very long time. There's been seminal work by lots of people, but it is time for us to remind each other of why it's important and redouble our efforts to focus on it. And so, you know, back in the 70s, George Engel came up with the biopsychosocial model that he used in medicine to think about, and particularly in psychiatry, to think about when treating an individual patient with mental illness, thinking about the biological factors, the psychological factors, and the social factors that go into making up that person's mental illness. And I once again state that we've sometimes tended to take our eye off the ball of the social factors and the role of that. So we're not saying anything new or different, but it does need to be restated, and we need to put extra emphasis on this in the world of mental health because we just haven't focused in on this as much as we should. And the other reason why it's so important for us to focus on this is because we have a crisis. We have an epidemic in this country. And people with mental illness are dying 25 years earlier, up to 25 years earlier than the general population. So, you know, we really don't have time to wait and to hesitate here. We need to figure out how to make large change that's going to impact and improve the health of this extremely at-risk, highly unequal population that's dying at high rates. That really, if it were any other population, we would be, you know, completely up in arms at this type of number, and yet it hasn't really mobilized us in the way that I feel we need to. And so the last thing I'm going to say about this before we move on to Michael's part of the presentation is that when we think about these issues, we have to think about them through the lens of culture. And this report came out by Dr. Satcher and the Surgeon General's report. It's the supplement to Mental Health that was out in 1999, and this is the 2001 supplement on culture, race, and ethnicity. And it really pointed out that the disparities, the inequities that we see in mental health, the ones that we said are driven by social determinants of mental health, that they are viewed through the lens of cultural diversity, age, and gender. And so we can't really start to address these disparities and these inequities if we don't think about these things from a cultural perspective. Okay, so now I will turn it over to Michael, and he's going to review the evidence.
Good morning. I'm a psychiatrist and a preventionist, but I'm also an MPH-er, as is Ruth, and so it always feels like coming home to come to this conference and to get away just for a few minutes from a department of psychiatry. I'm going to walk us through just three examples of the nine social determinants that Ruth outlined. We had initially planned to walk through all nine of them, but then we realized that there just isn't enough time, and so we're going to focus on three of these. The first is adverse early life experiences. And in my own field of psychiatry, this is the one that mental health professionals know the most about. And we view it as an individual level risk factor, and we also think of it in terms of the impact on families and communities and society, as opposed to some of the other social determinants that have received much less attention in the world of mental health. So just as one definition of an adverse early life experience, these are inconsistent, threatening, hurtful, traumatic, or neglectful social interchanges experienced by fetuses, infants, children, or adolescents. And I bet that many of you are familiar with the ACE study. A series of studies, more than 60 publications, I believe, has really garnered a lot of attention, not only in mental health, but across all health disciplines. And the ACE study measured 10 ACEs, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse, emotional and physical neglect, and then five other types of adverse early life experiences that historically had not been addressed to the extent that childhood maltreatment had been addressed. And those include mother being treated violently in the home, household substance abuse, household mental illness, parental separation or divorce, and having had an incarcerated household member. So these 10 items were summed up, and as it turns out, more than 60% of the population surveyed reported one or more ACEs. And the particular population initially surveyed were fairly well-to-do people who had insurance. And so even in that large sample, more than 60% had at least one ACE. And if you look at these in other populations, you see, in fact, much higher rates of adverse childhood experiences. So I mentioned that there have been multiple studies that have followed up on the original ACE study, and many of those articles have focused on social and mental health outcomes, but also physical health outcomes. And pretty much every health outcome that you can think of has been associated with adverse early life experiences in terms of being a risk factor. So things like alcohol use disorders, depression, substance use, suicide attempts, but even things like hearing voices, and of course the chronic health conditions that we're aware of, diabetes, hypertension, overweight and obesity, STDs, etc. So this is a very robust risk factor across diverse health, mental health, and social outcomes. For some of those outcomes, there appears to be sort of an exponential increase in risk as your number of ACEs increases. So you can see here from zero ACEs up to more than six ACEs, the odds ratio for a suicide attempt increases dramatically. This pyramid tries to depict how adverse early life experiences work. And that is that because they're occurring across childhood and through adolescence, which are critical periods of neurodevelopment, the idea is that these can disrupt neurodevelopment, lead to social, emotional, and cognitive impairment, therefore the adoption of high-risk health behaviors, and ultimately disease, disability, social problems, and even early mortality. So that's one example of a social determinant of mental health. Another that I'll talk briefly about is food insecurity. This is a depiction of food insecurity by the artist Candy Chang, and it really defines what food insecurity is, and that is that it's that you're not sure that you'll have enough food to last to the end of the week or to the end of the month. We often think about hunger, and we hear a lot about hunger, especially in low and middle income countries. And so I wanted to define hunger, even though I think it's less relevant in our country than food insecurity. So hunger is really the uneasy or painful sensation that we've all experienced from time to time due to, in this case, recurrent and involuntary lack of access to food. And it can be related to food insecurity. So in many countries, food insecurity does in fact lead to this physiologic sensation of hunger. Hunger is a potential but not obligatory consequence of food insecurity, as exemplified in our country. So really, hunger is a measure of the severity of food insecurity at the level of the individual from a physiological standpoint. How does hunger differ from food insecurity? Food insecurity is a condition at the household level wherein the availability of nutritionally adequate and safe foods or the ability to acquire such foods is limited or uncertain. So in the U.S., although we don't hear a lot about hunger per se, we have a massive problem with food insecurity. In fact, roughly 14% of the population is food insecure at some point during the year, and this is occurring year after year after year. We see that the rate of food insecurity, which is measured by the USDA, is not really declining. In fact, it's holding quite stable, around 14 to 15% each year in our country. The WHO suggests that food insecurity or food security is really built upon these three pillars. One is food availability, another food access, and finally food use. And so I would suggest that in the U.S., we don't have a problem with food availability. In fact, we probably have more food than we need, and we could distribute that food to other populations. We have plenty of food in this country, so the availability of food is not the issue. I would also suggest that food use is not the issue in our own country. Most every dwelling, whether it's a house, an apartment, a condo, a homeless shelter, has the appliances needed to properly use food. That is, store food, cook food, etc. So food use is not really the problem. The problem in our country is food access. That is, we have a huge availability of food, but not everyone in our society has equal access, or even access at all to that food, especially nutritious foods. So we have a problem with food insecurity, and we have some evidence that food insecurity is linked not only to physical health, but also to poor mental health, especially in terms of depression, anxiety disorders, self-reported mental health status, poor academic and social functioning in kids, behavioral problems, hyperactivity, and inattention also in kids, and even an increased risk of suicidal ideation. So there are a handful of publications in the literature that show that food insecurity is in fact linked to important mental health outcomes. And I'll walk very briefly through just a couple of these studies. So this one used NHANES data, particularly 15 to 16-year-old U.S. adolescents, and they looked at the risk of major depression, dysthymia, and suicidality as they relate to the prevalence or the experience of food insecurity, while controlling for a number of other socioeconomic variables. And they found that food insufficient adolescents were significantly more likely to have had depressive disorders and even suicidal ideation compared to non-food insufficient peers. Again, controlling for a host of other socioeconomic risk factors. Another example comes from the UK, This was a 7-year longitudinal study among families, and they found that food insecurity is associated with lasting emotional distress, particularly anxiety and depression, for children, again, independent of other socioeconomic factors. So even when you control for the primary underlying cause of food insecurity, that is, constricted financial resources, you still see an effect of food insecurity on mental health. Food insecurity also affects maternal mental health. So this study looked at a large group of mothers of 3-year-olds and found that there was a positive correlation between food insecurity and major depression and generalized anxiety disorder among mothers of 3-year-olds. The reason this is particularly important is because 3-year-olds need mothers who are mentally healthy in order to have successful neurodevelopment. And so we can see that there could be sort of a transgenerational effect of food insecurity at the level of psychology, but perhaps also at the level of genetics. We're hearing more and more about epigenetics and how even nutrition could affect genetic expression. My sense is that food insecurity can set the stage for poor mental health and even increased risk for particular mental illnesses, but it's also likely that poor mental health and mental illnesses set the stage for food insecurity. So like the other social determinants, among people with mental illnesses, especially serious mental illnesses, there's probably sort of a cycle that people find themselves in. So the USDA not only measures food insecurity, but also does a great deal to try to address food insecurity in our country. There are a number of nutrition and food support programs at the USDA, the largest by far of which is SNAP, formerly called food stamps. Here are some details about the SNAP program if you're not familiar with SNAP. And this is a program that it's the USDA's largest program. Much of the USDA budget goes to SNAP. And this program is really designed to expand during times of economic downturns, such as the recent Great Recession, and then to constrict as the economy improves. And so in this top graph, you can see that the yellow graph is the number of individuals in poverty in our country, and below that in red, the number of SNAP participants. And you can see that it tracks very closely with the number of individuals living in poverty. The lower graph is a projection of SNAP up to the year 2021. And so several years ago, we heard a lot of political discourse about how SNAP is expanding beyond all control and that food stamps is out of control and we've got to do something to rein in this particular entitlement. And really, it was expanding because of the Great Recession. The program is designed that way, and it's projected that in coming years, as the economy recovers, SNAP will constrict accordingly. I'm not going to say much about what are called food deserts. You all probably know what food deserts are. Those are geographic locations where there's limited access to nutritious foods. But they commonly occur also in food swamps. And this is a picture of a food swamp where there's more than enough food, but it's all the sorts of food that do not go toward promoting physical health or promoting mental health. So in our country, food insecurity is not, in fact, linked to underweight and malnutrition. In fact, it's linked to overweight and obesity. And although on initial glance this might seem like a paradox, it's actually not at all a paradox. And the reason for the linkage between food insecurity and overweight and obesity is because people use their limited money wisely in order to buy the most calories that they can get per dollar. The average SNAP benefit in this country per meal is $1.50. So if I give you $1.50, you're probably going to go buy as many calories as you can for that to ward off that unpleasant physiologic sensation of hunger. And so people experiencing food insecurity tend to rely on diets that are very dense in calories, high in salt, high in sugar, high in fat, and very depleted in terms of micronutrients. The third example that I'm going to talk briefly about of another social determinant of health and social determinant of mental health is poverty and income inequality. Here are some statistics about poverty in America. The federal poverty line for a one-person household is close to $12,000. For a family of four, just over $24,000. So think about a family of four making $24,000 and what it's like to try to put food on the table and try to provide all the other basic needs. Near poor is defined as between 100% and 200% of the federal poverty level. And similar to the statistic on food insecurity, about 14 to 15% of Americans live in poverty each year. Shockingly, though, about 40% of children in the U.S. are poor or near poor. So this is really the juvenilization of poverty. And it's really shocking that poverty is so apparent among kids because kids have developing brains. And this is why poverty and indeed income inequality probably have a prominent effect on mental health in addition to physical health. Another aspect of poverty and income inequality is what's called neighborhood deprivation. And this is really not about your own financial status, but about that of your neighborhood. And so, for example, an extreme poverty neighborhood is an area or a neighborhood where over 40% of households are below the federal poverty line. And there's this sense that neighborhood poverty has an effect on your own health, your own mental health, in addition to your own financial status. We know that poverty is linked to mental health outcomes, and we also know that it's linked in variable ways. That is, timing, duration, and the intensity of poverty probably matter substantially. We also know that income growth does not occur equally across the population. This is income growth between 1979 and 2005. And we can see that the top 1%, which we hear a lot about, has been doing quite well in terms of income growth. But other brackets have not been doing nearly as well in recent decades. Poverty and income inequality are linked to diverse health, mental health, and social outcomes. I would recommend the book The Spirit Level, which really describes all of these outcomes in great detail. In terms of the ways that especially income inequality is linked to mental and physical health outcomes. So how might income inequality be linked to health? There are several potential pathways, and we need to not just point out the associations, but we need to understand the mechanisms, because it's by understanding the mechanisms that we can potentially identify targets for interaction. So I'll very, very briefly talk about three of the potential mechanisms or pathways through which income inequality influences health. The first is simply that there's an increased burden of poverty among societies with a larger extent of income inequality. And since we know that poverty itself is an individual level risk factor, it makes sense that income inequality is not good for society because it's associated with a higher proportion of society who is impoverished. Another pathway is through psychosocial mechanisms. Societies with a larger extent of income inequality generate more damaging stress levels throughout the population, but especially for those lower down in the social scale. And this stress results in greater anxiety, insecurity, a sense of lack of control over living and working conditions, And all of these, we know, set the stage for psychological stress responses and even physiological stress responses that can increase the risk for mental illnesses like depression and anxiety and substance use, which are our most prevalent mental illnesses. Furthermore, the perception of your place in the social hierarchy may produce additional negative emotions that translate into poor health and poor mental health. And then there are also sort of the public policy pathways. Income inequality results in more limited investments in health and education, and smaller social and economic inequalities improve the possibilities of maintaining and developing welfare systems in the society that are financed according to ability to pay and utilized according to need. And so we all know that societies with lesser income inequality do a better job at investing in education, health, etc. This is a slide from The Spirit Level, the book that I recommended, and there are many of these similar graphs in that book, and they all pretty much look the same. There's this very clear direct association between the level of income inequality in society and the prevalence of the particular health outcome and mental health outcome in that society. And so this is just a handful of high-income societies plotted by their level of income inequality and the percent of that society reporting the presence of a mental illness. And we see this very clear direct correlation. Even among the states, there is substantial variability in income inequality, and we see this same direct correlation between the state's level of income inequality and the percentage of the population experiencing, in this case, depression. And there are many, many of these direct correlations that show that income inequality in society is associated with the level of health outcome in that society. So I'll stop here and turn it back over to Ruth.
So we're just going to take a little bit of time to think about how we might go about addressing these social determinants. And to think about that, we need to start with the health impact pyramid, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with by Tom Frieden and the CDC. And you can see that at the top of the pyramid, we have interventions such as counseling and education and clinical interventions. And as we move down to the bottom of the pyramid, we're dealing with things like changing the context to make individuals' default decisions healthy and socioeconomic factors. And so as you know, if you move down the pyramid, you have a greater population impact. And at the top of the pyramid, it requires more increasing individual effort. At the bottom of the pyramid, it requires less individual effort and it has a greater population impact. And I would submit that most of us, definitely myself, but many public health providers are working in the tops of this pyramid, doing counseling and education, doing clinical interventions, maybe starting to touch on some long-lasting protective interventions. But one of the things we are not maybe doing as well as we could is working on socioeconomic factors and changing the context to make individuals' default decisions healthy. So I'll spend just a little bit of time talking about how to address the social determinants from the top of the pyramid, but we recognize that the real meat of the work is going to come at the bottom of the pyramid. And so let's just take a little bit of time to talk about some examples of how action on the social determinants works and what that looks like. So here are just kind of some best practice examples, and I'll go over them very briefly. The Nurse Family Partnerships looks at first-time pregnant teens and their newborn baby and designs an intervention in which they have home visitation. So the nurse will come out to the house of the parent, the new mom, and prior to pregnancy and then after birth for 2 years after birth. And it's a total of like a monthly visit for that period of time. And they looked at about 400 women enrolled in this project. And after 15 years, when they did this follow-up, they found decreased number of subsequent pregnancies, increased time between pregnancies, and then as we look at some of these mental health outcomes, decreased use of welfare, decreased child abuse and neglect. So what we see here is that this nurse-family partnership acts directly on adverse early childhood experiences when we think about that social determinant of health. Decreased mother's criminal behavior and decreased behavioral impairment due to alcohol and drugs. So a reduction in substance use and a reduction in adverse early childhood experiences from this particular intervention. And then the high-scope Perry preschool study, which we also know informed Head Start. This is early education, and it looked at children, and they particularly picked children that were deemed at risk for school failure at age 3 and 4, and they did a learning program with home visits associated. They collected data all the way up to age 40. And what they found for those kids that took place in the High Scope Perry program, as opposed to the kids that were not in that program, that the High Scope Perry kids had higher rates of high school graduation. So now we're looking at education as the social determinant that we're impacting. Higher IQ and test scores at age 7. Better attitudes of the child and parent to school, meaning increased connectedness in that school. We had higher employment rates for those children at age 27 and age 40, higher income levels for those children when they grew up, lower use of social services, lower rates of arrest and criminal activity, less substance use, and higher reports of getting along with their family members. We were talking about an early childhood intervention at age 3 to 4 that had this kind of lasting impact on the life of the children that participated in this study. Another example is the Good Behavior Game. This is a healthy development program in which they tested this intervention on first and second grade students. It was developed in the 60s, and they did intervention trials in Baltimore City public schools. So what the Good Behavior Game does is they group children into teams, and you start out with little 10-minute sessions on these teams with rules, and the rules are basic. The rules are we will work quietly, we will be polite to others, we will get out of our seats with permission, and we'll follow directions. And so if the kids followed the rules, they got rewarded. They got erasers and pencils. But they only got the reward if all of the students did this. So there was a lot of peer pressure to behave properly from the other students in your group. And so if, as the behavior improved, the sessions became longer and longer than 10 minutes and they got awarded more more things, this intervention continued through all the way to sixth grade. And then they looked at students at age 19 and 20. And they found really robust results for the boys. Some results for the girls, but much more for the boys. And all of the boys had improved outcomes as young adults compared to the kids that did not participate in the Good Behavior Game. But the most aggressive or deemed aggressive boys had the most robust results in this particular study. And at age 19 and 20, they had decreased substance abuse, decreased smoking, decreased delinquency and incarceration, and decreased likelihood that an aggressive boy would get a diagnosis of conduct disorder or another personality disorder. And so if you look at these results, you can see that there were significant improvements in these outcomes with the Good Behavior Game classroom compared to the regular classroom. So you could see, like I said, there was some improvement in females, particularly around alcohol abuse and dependence disorders and around suicide thoughts. But all of these are mental health outcomes that you see huge differences just by this teeny little intervention that you can do in a classroom. And it begs the question, why doesn't this happen kind of universally in our classrooms and our schools? Another example is Health Leads. Rebecca Oney is the creator of Health Leads, and she's actually speaking here today at 12:30. And apparently, if not on the program, it was left off the program. So she's going to be giving a talk immediately after this talk, and it would be great to see. She's a great speaker, and she can describe her program much better than I would. So I'm going to leave that to her if you get a chance to see that. But basically, that's a little hard to read, but what I'll tell you is that a patient comes in seeking medical care in the hospital, and medical student volunteers then kind of operate as advocates for those patients. So the doctor that sees the patient writes a prescription. It's something that we like to call social prescribing. So the doctor writes a prescription. If the person is homeless, they write a prescription for housing. Or if the person doesn't have access to food or has food insecurity, they write a prescription for food. And then the medical student advocate works directly with the social service agencies and with that patient to make sure that that person gets those things. Because we know those things impact health, and so we need to take action in the clinics to do that. So like I said, she can explain it better, and I'll leave that to her. Medical legal partnership is an example that's really effective and growing dramatically. We see that many of the social determinants have to do with legal issues. Laws, we talked about distribution of opportunity, we talked about social norms and public policies, so we know that laws have a role to play. And many laws aren't being effectively enforced for certain populations. So if people are living in unsafe or unhealthy housing, or if they're denied certain benefits, these are legal interventions that can be made to ensure that these people get what they need. And so they work across a variety of areas. It could include income, supports and insurance, housing and utilities, employment and education, and it also includes legal status and personal and family stability. Legal status meaning immigration. So I come back to this figure to say that we're thinking now about how the distribution of opportunity and the public policies of social norms drive these social determinants of mental health. And so we really need to be operating at the very bottom of this particular figure. We need to be thinking about public policies, and we need to be thinking about social norms. And in so doing, we'll be operating at the bottom of the health impact pyramid as well. So if you want to think about clinical interventions, they could include screening for mental health conditions, creating policies and work settings that address the determinants, like creating resource guides and giving people materials as to where they might go to get services that they need, and referring clients for available supports like supported education and employment, SNAP benefits, poverty assistance programs. But policy interventions are key, and this is just kind of a thought, but I'd really like to hear everybody else's perspective on how we can move forward on the policy interventions. When we think about public policies, one of the ways we can try to affect public policies is to advocate for policies and laws that improve all of these factors. So it becomes a very political issue, and it requires us to get very political. And we can also, I think a lot of times we don't recognize how much expertise we have, particularly in the eyes of lawmakers. We should be offering that expertise to our lawmakers. We should be going, we should know our representatives, we should be knowing our local representatives, who oftentimes have a lot of influence and are very accessible, but we don't necessarily take the time to get to know them and give them our expertise. So that's one key. And then a huge important factor is cross-sector collaborations. So working outside of your field with other people who may or may not seem like they have the same interests, but actually do. So that means working with police officers, working with teachers, working with city planners, any number of people in various areas, because we're talking about health in all policies. And that means in every aspect, every policy that we think about is a health policy. And so anybody, anytime we're debating an issue, there's a health angle and thus a mental health angle that we should be considering. And then the other piece of the pie there would be social norms. And this is a little bit more complicated. This is changing attitudes, changing behaviors. And it requires community education and engagement. It requires focusing on that cultural competence piece. It requires addressing stigma in mental health, which is challenging. We have presenters here at this conference that are experts in stigma. Drs. Pesca-Salido and Corrigan are presenting, I believe, is it tomorrow? Tomorrow. And then we also need to think about how we can use the law to help change these cultural norms. A lot of times our attitudes and our beliefs are not enough. Sometimes we need to set laws to actually precede people's attitudes and beliefs and to then change people's attitudes and beliefs. And so one of those, we need to start advocating for the right policies that are improving the social norms for people with mental illness. Okay, so we have some time for questions and discussion, and I leave you with this quote from the Commission on Social Determinants of Health. Reducing health inequities is an ethical imperative. Social injustice is killing people on a grand scale. So we'll take some questions.
So the community guide is the CDC and community equivalent of the USPSTF, which gives clinical preventive interventions. This is really the guide for community preventive interventions. And I think you're exactly right. And one question is, how many mental health professionals sit on the committee? I don't know. My guess is not enough.
And I would also just add to that that many of these social determinants of health interventions are social determinants of mental health interventions, and nobody has yet pointed that out to the appropriate people. So part of it is just increasing the awareness. They're not different. They're the same interventions. Those examples we talked about are championed as physical health interventions. But they're actually mental health interventions, and nobody has ever taken the time to stop and say, wait a minute, this improves mental health as well. So part of it is, one, having the right representation, and two, advocating for the focus, which has not been on mental health. Oh my gosh, there's too many questions. I don't even know where to begin.
Thank you. Thank you for an excellent presentation. I really appreciate what you said about public policy. And I want to recommend an organization to probably get involved that I was for 24 years called Results, results.org. And we train individual citizens to lobby our government around poverty, around hunger, around food insecurity in the U.S. and also globally. And we actually have a number of countries. We do this in a number of countries. And I'll just say, it's about relationships with public policymakers. And if my long experience having gone to D.C. for the last 27 years every summer is, if people knew the power that they had in speaking and making these relationships, they would never be quiet. We give up more power in our silence than is ever taken from us by silence.
Thank you for stating that. I totally agree with you. Thank you. Question back here.
Hi, I'm Frederick Wilson. I'm a Harvard
There are some sort of screening tools that can be used for each of the social determinants that we talked about. And in fact, there are also screening tools that combine a number of those social determinants. So one is the iHealth screening tool, which covers five or so of the social determinants with just a couple of questions for each of those so that you can begin to get a sense for the person's level of socioeconomic disadvantage.
Not yet. We're working on that.
What is it called?
iHealth. That's the Medical Legal Partnership screening tool. So if you go to the Medical Legal Partnership's website, and actually if you Google iHealth screening, it might actually come up that way as well. IHELP.
I just wanted to respond to the comment that not enough has been done to link the commonality of social determinants across physical health and mental health. I wanted to mention that the policy committee of the mental health section had worked on a policy last year, which was approved by APHA, the title of which was, I think, support for social determinants, behavioral health, and pathways for integrated and better public health. It's been along at this end, but it might help as a vehicle for making
thank you for that. I don't know. Who's next?
Dr. Shin, you talked about the dilemma, or alluded to the dilemma of physical professions, as you put it, gay political. And I'm a Canadian, so I can talk about the Public Health Agency of Canada tool use. It's been criticized in Canada, for example, by Dennis Raphael at York University. And he adds dimensions like, why is Jason's father unemployed? Well, he's not employed because the protections have been taken out of the labor market in Canada, and spending has been moved out of the welfare state, and the tax system has become less progressive. And why has this happened? Because of free trade agreements where the Canadian workers are part of the labor out of work, and globalization factors. So I'm wondering if you're considering in the next edition of your book, taking the causes of the causes further back, perhaps into less comfortable
I think that's a great question, and I know what I would like to do. That definitely does not always exactly equate with where the field is. And so part of the issue is if you go too far at one time, a lot of times you're seen as, you know, a militant, angry person who has no value or relevance. So you have to move in very clear, calculated steps. The first step, from our perspective in terms of psychiatry and mental health, is to let people understand that this is an issue. The next step would be talking more about their role politically and how active they should be from a political perspective. So I totally agree with you, and I'd like to be out there, you know, picketing in front of the White House right now, but I recognize that things have to go in a certain order and speed. In the back there with the red. Yeah.
Thank you so much for your presentation. This is wonderful. I do want to ask, how do you, particularly in regard to AIDS and AIDS, how do you view the work of CDC and CDC in managing the stress, the depression, the anxiety in these kinds of environments? And I raise that because the VA has certainly demonstrated that they're using 15-week, 16-week workshops for veterans who are suffering from PTSD, specifically to build their skills around managing a lot of the emotional outcomes around their situation. So how do you view CDC and DDP in relation to AIDS?
Well, they're both great treatments. They're evidence-based. They are probably more relevant than Prozac for the types of things that we're talking about. So clearly we as a mental health field need to do more to disseminate these evidence-based psychosocial treatments. However, what we also really need to do is prevent the adverse early life experiences and the traumas and the combat exposure from happening in the first place. And so that's where the social determinants really comes in, trying to take a preventive approach rather than dealing with the sequelae, which are to some extent, you know, already done. So they're great treatments, and I think our field is making progress, but we need to be equally focused on preventing those adverse early life experiences.
All the way in the back there.
So, great presentation. I have a comment slash remark. In listening to your presentation, really what it occurred to me that we might want to think from a college perspective about putting in some avenues in place for caregivers of grown children who are experiencing mental health issues. Because when you're in that kind of situation, you're not, after you reach the age of 18, you're very familiar with things that the individual can do. And we know that mental health problems are across the ground. You don't necessarily have to be a danger to yourself and others to be causing low level stress in your household, which then can affect the mother and other children and other the father and so on and so forth. So, I think when we think about the political context, we also want to think about putting in metrics for caregivers of grown children to be able to address some of these issues so that the cycle doesn't continue where it is.
Thank you.
In our community, we started up one of the trauma-informed community initiatives, and we got a Gainesville, Florida, and it's called Peace for Gainesville. And actually, they asked us, we got funding, mostly because we're calling ourselves Peace. But we're actually calling from the first trauma-informed community in Florida, from Tarpon Springs. But we got college medical, college law, mental health, and other Center for Peace Building. And so we're making a system of care. And we attended as a group of our little founding group, our resilience conference in Halifax, Nova Scotia this summer, where they talk about the fifth wave of resilience research, which is really about changing the odds while beating the odds. So beating the odds while changing the odds, that's the order. So it's really social justice plus resilience at the same time. And we're working to maybe develop what we call a new vital sign, which is resilience. Resilience over AIDS. And so we've got AIDS education going, and we just encourage you to go to our website, but think in your community what you can do to start connecting up with other people, and that's what we're doing.
Thank you. We got a collection of folks right here. Go ahead.
I think it was just a lot of hands went up. So I also appreciate your presentation. Probably work with the social determinants
For substance use, definitely. We know that many substance use disorders are actually more common in higher SES groups. So that finding is not particularly surprising. I don't know about the other finding, and I'm not actually familiar with that data. Question in the back? There's a little bit of research about stigma and food stamps. I don't know of much research, though, on other sorts of public benefits. But you're right, it's very difficult. And imagine navigating those systems when you have a serious mental illness like schizophrenia, which impairs cognition and your thought process, and also greatly affects the family in terms of the level of stress. So these things are not easy to sign up for, and I suspect that you're right in terms of your hypothesis that being on them could also lead to some level of stress and discrimination and stigma.
I think they've also done a little bit of research on unemployment benefits and mental health. And I think the data's been a little bit equivocal because some people have better mental health once they've lost their job but receive unemployment benefits. But then up to a point. And then after a certain period of time, then the mental health kind of trails off if they've been on unemployment benefits for an extended period of time while they're waiting for another job. So there is some data on it, but it's sparse and it hasn't looked at all. I know people have wanted to look at disability insurance and disability, like Social Security disability, and how that impacts mental health, but I